This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Jessica Crichton. Welcome to the Woman's Hour podcast.
Now, how does our menstrual cycle affect us when it comes to sport and exercise? British athlete Dina Asher-Smith last night spoke about her recent struggles when it comes to competing. But what solutions are there? We'll hear from a former athlete who tells us she had to track her periods a year in advance to ensure she could compete at her best. We'll also be talking sisterhood this morning with the stars of a new comedy drama series that's being released today. It centres on five Irish sisters, and when one of their husbands dies, his life insurers begin to suspect not all is as it seems among these women. It's intriguing. I've watched the first episode. Also, we continue to hear stories of Ukrainian people coming to the UK after escaping the Russian invasion. This morning, we'll be talking to a woman who fled her homeland back in June whilst heavily pregnant. She's recently had her baby here in the UK after finding refuge in Devon. She'll be telling us her story about leaving her husband and everything she knew behind. I want to ask you about fangirls this morning. Are you a fangirl, or have you ever been one? Maybe you were part of Beatles mania in the 60s, or are you a current member of Beyoncé's Beehive? Is there a pop star or a pop group that you're a super fan of who you relate to, or perhaps you wish you could emulate, would love to meet, or maybe you're just simply blown away by their musical talent? I remember when I was growing up, I had friends in love with Take That posters all over the walls. Now, I'm asking about this because female superfans are often portrayed as being hysterical, obsessive, almost unhinged. They're rarely seen in a positive light. I'll be speaking to two women who believe the fangirl image has been misunderstood, and actually they play a big role in influencing global politics. Maybe you experienced this as a superfan. Was there a message that you stood for, or a social or political situation that you wanted to change as a fangirl? Get in touch. You can WhatsApp us now on 03700 100 444. I would love to hear your voice notes if you'd like to send them. Pictures as well are welcome. Remember though, if you WhatsApp us, that data charges may apply. You can also text us on 84844. Texts are charged at your standard message rate. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour, and you can almost email us as well via the Woman's Hour website. So all of that to come, but first this morning, the British sprinter Dina Asher-Smith has called for more research into the effect of periods on performance after her cycle caused her to pull up with cramp at the European Championships, which are currently being held in Munich. Now, Dina initially thought her recovery strategy, or maybe hydration, may be to blame after she limped out of Tuesday's 100-metre final. But after qualifying fastest for today's 200-metre final, she spoke on the side of the track and said it was actually her period that was to blame.
Something that I think more people need to actually research from a sports science perspective, because it's absolutely huge. And people don't always talk about it either, because sometimes you see girls that have been so consistent, there's a random dip, and behind the scenes they've been really struggling. But obviously outwardly to everybody else, it's like, what's that? That's random. So, but it would just do with more funding, because yeah, I feel like if it was a men's issue, we'd have a million different ways to combat things. But with women, there just needs to be more funding in that area.
Well, Dina isn't the only athlete who's spoken out about this. Jasmine Sawyers, the long jumper, last night won a bronze. and she's also raised this issue. Her former coach and former heptathlete and Olympic bronze medalist Kelly Southerton joined me earlier to discuss this very matter.
When you have to perform at your best and then you're on a cycle, it sometimes can play havoc with everything. So it's a very familiar story. It seems one that doesn't go away. It comes up, pops its head up and goes away. But there's, even in my day, this was being talked about in my day, like 15, 20 years ago, it's still, there's no any solutions out there. And that for me is, why isn't that happening? Is there, you know, what is the medical world in sport doing about supporting athletes, female athletes, who are really truly affected by their menstrual cycle?
Yeah, we'll come to possible solutions in just a moment. But first, you said it wreaks havoc on your body. Just describe to people how it impacts your performance when you're on your period.
So for me, when I was an athlete, for instance, the week prior to, I'm going to say it, bleeding was the most terrible time for me. That's when I'd most likely get injured. So it was about managing how you trained and performed. So then we trained our training cycle to fit our menstrual cycle. But that meant that obviously then I had to be on some kind of contraceptive to manage that as well. And then manipulating a contraceptive pill to ensure that your periods in a year's time are when they should be and when you want them, based upon competition. So so it can injure you if you overtrain. Recovery can be affected mentally. We all know sometimes you can maybe not be so high on concentration levels and may make silly mistakes and errors that you wouldn't do any time of the month. But also just, you know, and things like, most obvious leakage, you know, you're putting your body through a lot of stress and strain, running, pushing yourself to the limits, then you've got to watch out for the simple leakage thing. So it's like, that's not nice. And that's not something you should have to worry about on a day to day when you're trying to perform at your best.
What kind of mental impact does that have on you?
You know, I think straight away when you're on your period anyway, day to day life, I suppose you just feel a little bit down. You don't feel as high as you would normally feel because you know something's just affecting you. And sometimes it doesn't really affect you. In some days and times of the month, it really does. And I suppose it's just something that women have to deal with alongside everything else. And as I said, it can affect women outside of sport, and it could be debilitating in their everyday world. You know, I know friends who have to take time off work and they're not elite performers, but I also know there's elite performers who have that situation. And Jess Sawyers a couple of years ago was a great illustration, and I did train her and see her through a situation where she physically couldn't train because her cramps were so bad and that she wanted to go to the hospital. So it's like nobody should have to have that concern when, you know, you're putting on a British vest and you're trying to perform your best for your country. It shouldn't be that thing in your head that you're worrying about. It should be just performing.
And you mentioned there the anxiety over possibly leaking whilst you're on your period. I mean, the outfits that athletes tend to wear, female athletes in particular, very, very tight.
Yes.
Not much space in those outfits. That must be an added worry on top of that.
Yeah, I think so. I think there was a tennis player recently from the Wimbledon whites. And, you know, like if you're on your period and you're wearing white, you know, sometimes if you're on a heavy period, it doesn't matter what kind of sanitary wear you have, you can still leak. And that's not nice. Yes, and in athletics and I suppose in swim, anywhere, in any sport where you're wearing very tight fitting clothes into your body, you know, there is a concern, like, oh God, what happens if? So you shouldn't be worried about that. I mean, I think as I keep going back, this is not just about elite performance. Well, it is, but also every day when we're in a heavy period, you do think about it, because you don't, if you're going out or you're wearing something light, you don't want to have that leakage. It's that's like the most embarrassing thing ever. I think if anybody watched Sex and the City, the new one, when Charlotte had a leakage and she was walking around with a period mark on her trousers, nobody wants to do that because it's just highly embarrassing.
Yeah, it's really seen as quite taboo. So what are the solutions then, Kelly? Because you said you trained an athlete through this very situation in Jazz at Sawyers. What did you offer her in terms of support and advice?
Well, I really couldn't offer that much in terms of, you know, because she just had some debilitating pain for that moment. We just took her to the hospital and they said, oh, just get over it. It was there was nothing we could do. I think the athletes need to have the confidence and to have those conversations with their coaches and the people around them and their peers. So at the moment, there doesn't seem to be any real medical advice out there in the sporting world.
Does that shock you that after years of it being talked about, no medical advice has come out yet?
Yeah, I do. I understand research takes time, but, you know, I'm sure there'll be plenty of females out there. If there was any research trials in terms of, you know, dealing with some of these issues, that they would jump on it. You know, so all I could suggest is there a non-medical forum where there's been, you know, obviously we have an array of brilliant female athletes in this country and around the world. There's an open forum to offer solutions, not just to athletes, but to coaches, how to deal with certain things. As I suggested earlier, when I trained, I've worked out my cycle a year in advance. I allowed my training to fit my cycles. And that did help. I was injured less. I got severe menstrual migraines, which I still train through. So it was just like, how did you do it? What did you do? What are your solutions? And just offering advice from others and supporting others just needs to be a conversation. I do think coaches aren't prepped in this, probably more male coaches. It's an uneasy conversation to have with, you know, a female athlete, you know, about your periods, but you have to be open to your coach and they have to know everything about you for them to be able to help you to perform at your best.
Former heptathlete Kelly Salverton. So what sort of research is actually being done into this area? Well, Dr. Richard Burden is co-lead on female health and performance at the English Institute of Sport and joins me now. Good morning, Richard. As you heard there from Kelly Salverton, she doesn't feel as though much research has been done into this area, at least research that's been made public. What can you tell us about the research that you're doing?
I understand the frustrations, you know, from someone like Kelly and for athletes out there and the general population. But I hopefully I can assure people that we are trying. So at the English Institute of Sport, we have a specific female athlete health and performance program with a very broad remit of trying to improve health and performance support for female athletes across the high performance system, starting with, you know, some of the things that Kelly mentioned, like education. So, you know, kind of bespoke education for athlete groups, for coaching groups, for support staff groups, so that we can increase the kind of the general level of understanding around some of the challenges that are specific to female athletes. Because if we're able to do that, then hopefully we kind of set the foundations for people to have more informed conversations and be more comfortable having conversations between athletes and coaches.
Nadina Asher-Smith said in that interview, that clip we played out, she said that if this was a men's issue and it was men's hormones all over the place, a solution would have been found by now. What do you think about that?
Yeah, she's probably right. I can't argue with that. All I would say is that, you know, we've definitely recognised the need that we need to provide better information, more information, be more proactive with the support from both a health and performance point of view. So alongside education, we're developing technology, we're developing areas of research to improve our understanding of, for example, of how the menstrual cycle influences health and performance so that we can pass on that information to athletes and their coaches.
Yeah, Kelly mentioned obviously a lot of negatives when it comes to the menstrual cycle, but there are certain advantages at some points in the cycle for athletes as well, isn't there?
Well, I think that like the biggest advantage would be like everyone understanding how it might affect an individual, because ultimately it is a very individual, it's a very individual thing. I'm very conscious that I'm a bloke. I'm never going to have a menstrual cycle, so I'm never going to experience it. But what I do know is that it is individual. So between athletes, they won't experience the same thing, both from the biology and their experience of it. So that we need to create better ways and better information that actually individualizes our support, because kind of blanket approaches, whether it's clinical approaches or performance approaches, one size fits all just doesn't work anymore.
Yeah, I think that's clear. And there's clearly a lot of work still to be done. Dr. Richard Burden, thank you for coming on to Woman's Hour. Now, let's talk about a new dark comedy series from the award-winning writer, producer and actress Sharon Horgan. You might know her from shows such as Motherland, Pulling, Catastrophe and Divorce. Well, her new series is called Bad Sisters, and it follows the Irish Garvey sisters who have always looked out for each other. Now, when their brother-in-law dies, his life insurers start an investigation to prove the sisters were involved. The first two episodes of the series are available to watch globally from today on Apple TV+. Eve Hewson plays one of the sisters called Becca, and Sharon Horgan plays another called Eva, and both join me now. Very good morning to you, Eve and Sharon. How are you?
Good.
Hi, good.
Good to have you on Woman's Hour. So Sharon, could you just...
I'm a little woolly.
Oh, that's fine. Good. That's fine. I'm looking at you through the screen and you look very glamorous, I have to say. Just tell us a bit about the story, Sharon, and who you play and a bit about your character.
So like you said, it's about the Garvey girls. They're five sisters. One of their sisters is married to a real piece of work, a monster of a man, and her other four sisters decide that the only way around that is to kill him. I mean, that sounds a bit extreme.
But they build this as a comedy, Sharon.
the comedy is, I think, that they try and fail. They're, like Eve Hewson says, they're not very good at murder. And so they keep trying and failing. And, you know, it's a bit of a cat and mouse because the insurance brother's trying to prove foul play and them trying to kill this awful human. I play Eva. She's the matriarch of the family. Their parents are dead and she's sort of, she sees them as her children really. But so I'm baby Becca's sort of mum.
Yeah. How was that, Eve, playing your character? Tell us about her. She's a massage therapist, isn't she?
She is. She's the youngest of the group. She's the only one who kind of hasn't figured it out yet. She's sort of in that phase. Everyone else has sort of got a career or a family and, you know, they're proper grown-ups, and she's the one who still feels like she's stuck in between childhood and adulthood. And she is very keen on killing this man, but maybe not as talented as her sisters at it.
I mean, who's really talented at killing people? Let's just give our listeners a taste of what's to come in this series. Here's a trailer.
I know you don't think he's a good man. Families, they're complex.
I'm warning you. She doesn't respect you because you're weak.
I found myself an old man tattooed on a sign.
She wasn't always like that. He's sucking the life out of her.
Well, we'll just have to wait till he dies of cancer or something.
Why not give nature a helping hand?
You're talking about taking a man's life.
Not a man, but monster.
That's demented.
Ooh. Now, Sharon, you wrote the series and it was adapted from a Belgian Flemish series. Tell me about the process, because you've had to adapt someone else's work rather than draw on your own experiences, or were you able to do both?
I think I was able to do both. I mean, the original Flemish series called Clan is completely wonderful. And I was on board from watching the first episode, really, especially because of this, the five sisters at the heart of it and just the premise I found so fun. But you know, there was lots I knew I would want to change, you know, to make it my own. Otherwise, what's the point in doing it? You know, people get really angry about adaptations that don't work or, you know, aren't different or better than the original. So, you know, I come from a big family. I've got two brothers, two sisters. We're a big sort of traveling circus of siblings. And So I felt like I'd be able to, you know, recreate that sort of mad energy on screen. And, you know, the original was so wonderful, but it was kind of broader. It kind of had, you know, Chinese mafia and hitmen and all sorts. So my notion was just that I wanted to ground it because, you know, at the heart is, you know, a very abusive, coercive relationship. And I felt like, you know, I wanted to, you know, respect that subject matter and make sure that, you know, I had the time and the space to explore that. But at the same time, you know, it is a comedy and it's quite madcap at times. So it's, I guess I just sort of have tried to hone the you know, dark comedy thing over the years. And it felt like the right show for what I've sort of learned over the years.
Yeah. And one of the overriding themes is sisterhood. Now, Eve, you have siblings. What does sisterhood mean to you? Were you able to draw on some of your own experiences and translate them into your character?
Absolutely. I think I said this in an interview the other day, but I described me and my sister as Liam and Noel Gallagher. We're like, we fight like cats and dogs, but we love each other madly. And so that, I mean, I grew up like, we're 2 years apart. We're basically like twins. We do everything together. We have the same friends, everything. So I understand that sister bond so much. And it was great because my sister came with me last night and it was just so nice to kind of have the real sister and then my TV sisters with me and sort of share that experience together was lovely. And I think anybody from any big family or, you know, like, you know, this is such a beautiful dynamic that we have. It's got so much going on in it. And I think people will like connect to it in a really spectacular way because we love each other, but we're fighting and then we're kissing and loving on each other again. It's great.
Yeah. Sharon, did you find that as well, that being part of a big family, having sisters, you were able to draw on those experiences for this series?
Yeah. And I met Eve's sister last night and she's she's just the image of her. She just looks like Eve, but you know, parallel universe Eve. I really was. I mean, my two of my siblings were there last night and my mum and dad. And I mean, we're not quite Liam and Noel Gallagher. We're more sort of the Nolans. we don't fight. Like, I think myself and my brother have had one fight in our lives. And that's when he moved in with me for a while. And then when it came to moving out, we just sort of both panicked and, you know, got a bit emotional with each other. But we have got that thing, though, where we're sort of an instant tribe. And if anyone tries to, you know, interfere with that or mess with us in any way, you've got someone there who's got your corner. And it's a nice feeling to know that someone has always got your corner, especially if they're 6'4", like my brother.
Nice to have that protection. Eve, obviously for you, so some listeners might not know this, but you come from a famous family. How does that dynamic impact the way you and your sister interact? And for people that don't know, your dad is Bono, lead singer of U2.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that I've always loved, having such a close bond with my sister, is that we kind of have always protected each other in growing up in a very sort of complicated but great, you know, situation. But it's a particular thing that's not kind of hard to explain. And we've helped each other through that so much. And I have two younger brothers as well. And so the four of us just sort of have this bond, I think, that I don't think we would have, you know, been able to turn out the way that we did have we not had each other. I think, like, you know, you kind of need that sort of person by your side.
What is it that makes it difficult, Eve, about growing up in the spotlight like that when your family is as famous as it is?
You know, it has a lot of wonderful things about it, but there's definitely a sort of a pressure about it and a fishbowl kind of aspect to it where people are watching you in a different way, especially, you know, as a child when you're growing up and you're learning about yourself. There's a sort of eyes on you that I think is not normal. So that's been important that we sort of have each other to lean on.
Sharon, watching the first episode, there's some absolutely beautiful landscapes used throughout the episode. And it's obviously shot in Ireland, in Dublin. Was it important for you for it to be shot there?
Yeah, I mean, I've been waiting for years to do this. You know, everything I've made has been London-based and it's been wonderful. But even Catastrophe, where I got to have, you know, an Irish family, any of the Ireland scenes we shot in, I don't know, Essex or somewhere.
Are you saying Essex isn't as idyllic as Dublin?
Beautiful, but it's not. So yeah, I've been waiting to do this for years, and just to get to do it on an Apple show, you know, where you know it's a bit more spendy, so you get to you know, really be quite spectacular with your vision for it. And we had an amazing director, Dervla Walsh, who I'd worked with before, and just we all adore her. And, you know, as important as the performances were and all of that, we were really quite obsessed with, you know, showing Ireland in a particular light, and especially the 40 foot, which is the sort of... you know, the men's, it used to be a men's only sort of swimming area in Dublin. And I don't think it's been sort of seen before on TV or that sort of that area anyway. And so getting that right, because it's a really special place that also doesn't make sense because it's just like a big heap of rock that people jump off.
Yeah.
But it's kind of magical, isn't it?
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's the most beautiful part, I think, of, I grew up about 5 minutes away from there. So it was very special to me to get to shoot there. And all of our friends came and watched us while we were shooting those scenes. And my mom brought down like teas and chocolate for everybody. It was a really, really special moment for me. Like, I grew up there and then we were sort of coming back doing this show. It was just fantastic. And if you ever go, that you have to go to the 40 foot and jump in the sea.
Well, I saw you in the first episode jumping off a cliff. I'm not sure I'll be trying that, Eve. Was that really you? Was that really you? Or did you have a stunt double?
That was really me. I had been practicing doing that. And when we got to do the scene, they told me I didn't have to jump off the cliff. And I was like, I've been working really hard at this. I'm getting this on camera. We have to do it.
He insisted on the jump off a cliff. I had written it and I'd completely forgotten. And I have to do this really quite pathetic dive in episode two. And I don't know how to dive. So I spent like the 2 days before going to various little spots around Ireland, jumping off rocks, just desperately trying to make it look like I knew what I was doing.
Absolutely brilliant. And just before we let you go, I mean, just talk to us briefly, Sharon, about the sisterhood, not just amongst your siblings, but with these group of co-stars. It seems like, I think the vibe between the five actresses, the five sisters, really comes out in the series.
Yeah, I think I just got really lucky with this group of women. You know, I kind of went to all my favorite actresses and said, will you do it? And thankfully I wrote Eve Houston a love letter, actually, just saying you have to do this show, and luckily she agreed. But like from the minute we started, you know, it was just there, this bond, like very supportive of each other on screen and off. And you know, our rehearsal period involved sitting around and chatting and swimming and doing those kind of things that you don't normally get to do. But then we spent 10 months together. So it was kind of hard not to, you know, become really intimate like a family over that time. And, you know, I'm mad about all of them. I've spent far too long looking at all their faces and I could keep watching. So I'm obsessed.
Brilliant. It's been such good fun talking to you, Sharon, and to Eve as well, stars of the new Apple TV Plus series Bad Sisters. And it's now available to watch globally from today. Thank you for coming on to Woman's Hour. Oh, now, one of the things Woman's Hour is
is well known for, is identifying the things about women's lives that we just don't talk about. Titania is a listener who emailed us when we asked how it feels to reach the age your mum was when she died. Jo Morris met her and asked to see a photo of her mum, Beverly.
I found one. I don't have very many. I just have one. This is my mum. She has brown eyes. She has a nose stud, which is cool.
Quite unusual for the 80s, a nose stud, isn't it?
Yeah,
actually?
I thought she was cool. Yeah. Those eyebrows that you would paint them on and draw them on. Very Dallas or yeah. Dynasty. She had those and bright red lips.
And how old is she in this photo?
I think she's about 44.
So your age?
Yeah, she's in her 40s, yeah. She was stunning. All the boys used to fancy her.
We're friends.
The boys on the street. Like, I grew up in Harleston. So she's driving through Harleston with the, like, convertible, roof down, and all the men's heads are just whipping left, right. Yeah.
So can you tell me a bit about your own situation?
I lived with my grandparents until I was 12, and my grandma died from non-smoker's lung cancer. And then I went to live with my mum, which was obviously quite difficult. And then when I was 29, my mum died from lung cancer as well. And my nan was 64 when she died, and my mum was 54 when she died, and I'm 44. I like numbers and patterns, so there's a thing there, yeah. Is this a pattern? Is this now my time? I'm 44, so is that it?
What did you think when you heard our call out for women coming up to the age of when their mum died?
I suppose I thought, actually, that could be me. That actually is me. Are there others like me? Light bulb moment, really. Yeah.
In what way?
It's there in your mind that you are approaching the age that your mother died or your grandma died. It's kind of an insane thought, so you kind of keep it in your head because it's wrong. So then you hear it and you're like, there are others.
There are others.
There are others.
Has this feeling got worse as you've got older, as you get nearer to the age?
It has.
So you're 44.
I am.
So you've got a way to go till you get to 54.
I do, yes.
Does it feel like that?
54 is not, it's not far away. But I keep telling myself don't be so silly. Don't think like that. Like, you have to be positive. You want to make sure that you are doing everything that you can to live as long as you can, because you want to see your grandchildren and you want to be around as long as you can. So you don't want to think like that. But then it's like there's two things on your shoulders, and one saying be sensible and be positive, and the other one saying, but you know, you're kind of showing certain signs. You do get pneumonia a lot, and you get a lot of lung infections, and isn't that what happened to your mum when she was your age? And she's like, and then you're thinking, no, I'm not going to do it.
Have you spoken to anyone about this before, Titania?
I suppose my husband would be someone that but then I don't want to worry him, so... so I don't really say so much about it. And, I went through this phase where after my mum died, I was speaking to the doctor and I was like, oh, it's not genetic. It's not genetic that we know of. They always like to add that bit that we know of. But we'll keep an eye on you just in case. Pre-COVID, it would just be ever present in the back of my mind. Whereas at the moment, it's very much in the forefront. I think I had COVID, which was really quite an experience. It was... experiencing what I'd seen my mum die from and my grandmother die from, not being able to breathe, it was mind-blowing.
So your nan brought you up for the first 12 years of your life?
Yeah.
And you called her your...
I called her my mum. Some of my siblings were there as well, but some were in care, but some were there as well.
And you thought of her as your mum, did you, at that time? Or?
Yeah, I called her mummy, although everyone called her mummy, but yeah.
Did so, they? Well, all the friends and neighbours
All the
and
friends,
stuff.
Neighbours, you know, the children on the street and cousins and everyone.
What was she like?
She was very, very bubbly, really happy, unless she was shouting at you. She came from Jamaica, so she had a Jamaican accent. You just do what she says. I was quite a good child.
Why didn't your mum bring you up?
She was just not able to. I don't think she was able to cope with us. Then when my nan died, we all had to go somewhere, so we had to work out who was going where. And I ended up going with my mum. she was party girl. So she was very cool. Like, she had a cool job and she'd hang out with cool people. She'd always be going to America or hanging out with Luther Vandross or doing something cool. She had parties, not Tupperware parties, like cool parties.
Not Tupperware parties.
Everyone else's mum were doing Tupperware parties or Avon parties, and my mum was having like a party party.
Did you call your mum mum?
No, I called her Beverly. My background and my childhood was quite complex. I would have been one of those children in the class that had, you know, special circumstances. All the questions, why do you call your mum Beverly? And who's that lady? That doesn't look like your mum. Because obviously my nan was a bit older. But I had a mum, and then she died, and then I had another mum, and then she died. So, yeah, twice. Or you could say I had two chances. I was lucky enough to have another mum, then after the first one died.
Can you take me back to a happy place with your mum, or a really good memory?
My mum loved music, and she particularly loved Luther Vandross. And so when she was really ill, we had a party here. I think it was my son's first Holy Communion, but there was DJs in the garden and we had a Luther Vandross song came on. Now, she could barely stand up. She died not too long afterwards. This song, Never Too Much, by Luther Vandross. Never too much, never too much. But it came
I
on.
I love it.
It's just such a tune. She used all of her strength to get out of that chair, and my auntie Marcia helped her. She got out of the chair and she danced to that song. And I mean, it literally exhausted her. You could see, but there was no way she was going to have that song on in the garden and not going to get up and dance. Da-da, da-da, da-da. I'm going to play my mum's song, Luther Vandross, Never Too Much. Such a tune. It was such a nice memory.
You're looking at her when you talk about her.
Yeah, I thought I should put it there. Is that a bit weird? That's on the sofa. Very positive. Like, she wouldn't think, oh, I'm dying. She wouldn't say that. She'd say, although she would use her cancer to get things. Like, she'd push to the front of the queue because she'd had cancer and she would tell everyone in the queue. We do that all the time.
Like, where do you mean? What sort of
Sainsbury's.
Sainsbury's.
Sorry, I have cancer. She's like, you've got to make the most of it, haven't you? She said, there's not many perks.
She says there's not many perks.
That's what she says, not many perks, yeah.
So when you look in the mirror, do you see your mum?
I wish. Oh, my God, have you seen this photo?
Do you think you'll do things differently to her? Or have you done things differently?
Yeah, so she didn't finish her university. So she wanted me to do that and do masters. And she wanted me to do that. She wanted me to buy a flat or a home. I've done that. She wanted me to not have four kids with four different men, so I didn't do that. She was really keen that we put the kids first. You know, when my nan died, she was in bed for, God, over a year. And I think she had to sort of come to terms with some of the decisions that she made with her children and with her just generally, and I think she found that quite difficult. She would always say, make sure you look after the kids, they come first.
Has it affected decisions you've made about your life?
I don't have a pension. I don't know any women in my family who've lived long enough to claim a pension. So I'm not going to do my pension. I'm going to opt out. Again, it's morbid, I know that, but I could also just be excusing my frivolity.
You don't fancy saving any money.
But yeah.
No, but seriously, was that a conscious decision you made not to have a pension?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reasons for not having a pension are many, but what I will say is I don't have any old people in my family, really.
So you're glad you've spoken about it?
I am, actually. I am really glad because, you know, I said before that I thought I was the only person. I thought it was an irrational fear that had to be sort of silenced and ignored and just tidied away somewhere safe and glass half full and all that, fine. You can have fears and worries and concerns. And speaking it doesn't make it true.
So how will you spend your 54th birthday, Titania?
It's going to be a party. Like a wholesome party. But not a normal party, it's going to be a wholesome party. It's going to be sound systems and sequins. Wow. I love that. I love that song so much.
Titania was talking to Jo Morris. Now, a plea for your help, if we may. We want to hear from you about gossip. Why do some people love to gossip? Is it just our way of sharing information? What do you do when you hear a juicy piece of information? Do you share it? And who do you share it with? Well, for our August bank holiday programme, we'd love to hear your best gossip stories. Maybe gossiping brought you closer together as a family, or maybe you lost friends because of it. We want to know. So you can send us a WhatsApp or a voice note on 03700 100 444. Remember that data charges may apply depending on which provider you have. You can also get in touch via text as well. The number is 84844. Text will be charged at your standard message rate. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour. And as always, you can email us through our website. Now, the massacre of hundreds of civilians in Bucha, Ukraine, has been one of the most significant events of the Russian invasion so far. Horrific images were seen around the world of people in the city who had been tortured and executed. Lena Kulikovska has just bought her first home in Bucha when the invasion started. But she stayed in Ukraine until June, hoping that the fighting would die down in time for her to give birth to her third child. In the end, though, she fled to the UK by road. She was 36 weeks pregnant and had to say goodbye to her husband, Sergei, at the Polish border. Well, Lena eventually settled in Devon, staying with the Archdeacon of Plymouth, Nick Shutt. She gave birth to her baby, Nicole, last month at the local hospital. And Lena joins me now. Good morning to you, Lena. Thank you for coming on to Women's Hour. Just tell us a bit about your life in Ukraine before the Russian invasion.
We have a great life in Ukraine. Ukraine is a very beautiful country, and we live in the capital of that country, in Kyiv. We have where to live, we have a job, we have our children were very glad because they have everything. They went to school, to kindergarten, they were happy to sometimes visit their granny, their cousins. It was everything okay.
And
we
then,
were happy.
And then how did life change once the invasion happened?
It's everything is changed. Every people Ukraine never forget that day, 24 February, when everything become another. You know, we have to start our lives from zero. We have to start our lives again. And that's why everything has changed.
Yeah, so I know that you were working as a manager in a restaurant and your husband, Sergei, was working in a coffee factory. And initially you wanted to stay in Ukraine despite the invasion, didn't you?
Yes, I want to say I have a very good job in Ukraine. I was a manager, restaurant manager, and I make events for many people. I have a very good job, and my husband also. That's why it was very hard for me to change everything, to make a decision to come here. We were very afraid to stay in Ukraine, but we hope that everything will be okay and we will get our job.
How difficult would it have been to give birth in Ukraine?
In Ukraine, it was difficult. It was danger to give a birth because sirens every time and rockets can fly every minute, everywhere. That's why I think that it's for me, it will be better to leave my country and to come here to Great Britain.
Yeah. And so you did that. But being as pregnant as you were so far along in your pregnancy, I mean, there was trouble for you to travel from Ukraine over to the UK. So how did you go about making that journey?
Oh, you know, it was really very hard. 4 days we come here. We stopped for two nights to sleep, but it was not all night, just a few hours because we need to travel. My host family, Nick Schott, he's helped me very much to come here. He and his staff, they made everything to make it more quickly. Organized everything very good. That's why 4 days and I come here.
Yeah, so you were put in touch with the Archdeacon there of Plymouth and you've settled down in Devon. So what's your experience been like since getting to the UK?
My experience to get in here?
Yeah, like how have you settled into the community?
Sorry, I don't understand. I mean, my English is not so well to understand.
That's absolutely fine. How does it feel living in the UK now?
You know, I live here now more than 2 months, and now for now I'm stopped to afraid, and for now I understand that I can think about my life, my future life. What can I do? Everybody here tried to help me, do everything that my I feel me in Great Britain good, and I want to say thank you, thanks all of you, all of people who live in here. Say thank for Nick Shutt and his family for their help in my family.
And congratulations on baby Nicole. How is she?
Oh, thank you. She's a very noisy girl. She wants to be me with her every time. And now I talk with you and she's crying upstairs.
Oh, no, I won't keep you too long. But how long do you expect to stay in the UK? Is your plan to go back to the Ukraine eventually?
First, my plan was to come back on September. Oh, she's here. First, my plan was come on September, come back. But now I understand that it's not can be true. Then I want to, I'm thinking about New Year, but I don't know how it can happen. I need now to think about plan B, to stay here maybe for a long time. And I understand that it will be very hard for me because I have 3 children and one of them is very small. But I hope that I can find maybe job for a few hours a day to stay here and to be useful here, not just to stay in.
Yeah. Best of luck, Lena, and thank you for coming on to Women's Hour to share your story.
Okay, thank you very much.
Now let's go back a little bit, shall we? Beatlemania in the 60s. Here's the Fab Four coming back from America to screaming fans.
Go on, scream, they're here. George, John, Paul and Ringo, the monarchs of Merseyside Sound. Do you reckon those crush barriers will stand the strain?
Well, that was 1964, but nowadays you have the One Directioners and Beyoncé's Beehive. In fact, there are loads of pop stars and pop groups plastered on bedroom walls and used as mobile phone wallpapers. Taylor Swift, Nicki Minaj, Harry Styles, K-pop's BTS, for example. So over the next few weeks, we'll be deep diving into this subculture of women who've often been ridiculed, labelled hysterical, obsessive, juvenile, even embarrassing. But have fangirls been misunderstood? Well, our next two guests think so. They believe fangirls can have a big influence over celebrity and pop culture and even global politics. Eve Blake is a playwright and songwriter who has written a musical called Fangirls that's touring at Sydney Opera House at the moment. And Hannah Ewins, who writes for Rolling Stone and is author of the book Fangirls, Scenes from the Modern Music Culture. Good morning to you both. I think, first of all, Eve, we need to just establish what is a fangirl exactly?
I mean, that's a great question, right? Because if you look in the dictionary, it's going to say a woman who is a fan of something. And in some dictionaries, it'll even say who is like overly enthusiastic about something, which I think is inherently gendered, right? But I'm really interested in the word fangirl as like a verb, because to me, to fangirl is to be able to express enthusiasm about something and to love something without apology. And I think that like, a lot of people really look down on fangirling because they see it as inherently cringe. But to quote like my favorite meme of the year, I think, you know, to be cringe is to be free.
I like that. Hannah, why do you think fangirls get such a bad rap?
Yeah, I think it's because like the people who have historically held the keys to things like journalism and documentation and music criticism have been overwhelmingly middle and upper class men. So we've always seen that fangirls have been stereotyped as what you see in photographs of fangirls, right? So like fangirls in a big group screaming and crying with their hands reached out and kind of like grasping at artists. And I think that this is obviously a really 2D idea, but we've never really had fangirls be like spoken to before, and really we haven't really looked into like who they are and what they do and why they do the things that they do. So we haven't had this like real understanding of who they are, and that's why they've had this really bad rep.
Talk about your experience then, Hannah, because you were a former fangirl. I find it interesting that you say former fangirl. So what were you going through emotionally? How did it make you feel when you were fangirling?
Yeah, so I used to be, firstly, I was a fangirl of Courtney Love. So I was, you know, that was a point of my life growing up as a little girl and being like just super angry. And I don't think I had anywhere to like channel the rage. So I kind of really modeled myself on Courtney Love, what she looked like, how she sounded, learned everything about her. And that was a very sort of private version of fangirling. And then fast forward like a couple of years and I got really into like scene culture when MySpace was a big thing, and I was very, very into the emo band My Chemical Romance. And that was a sort of different experience because that was when I was discovering mental health for the first time. And I was kind of getting online and speaking to a lot of other girls who were also really into this band, and we had this real sense of like camaraderie, and we kind of went to gigs together and things like that. So it was much more of the friendship side of fangirling. So I feel like I've sort of seen the two different sides of it, like a more private side and a personal side. And and that sort of like group activity side of being a fangirl.
Yeah, there's lots of facets to this. We've had a few messages coming from our listeners, and someone said, I'm currently writing my dissertation on how female fans are treated by the media. And she says she actually runs a company which is all about encouraging people to be more themselves. That is a huge part of it. Would you agree with that, Eve? And did you incorporate that into the musical that you wrote about fangirls?
Oh my gosh, 100%. Because like, Hannah, hearing you describe the community that you found being a fan, I'm so jealous, because really the reason I'm writing about fangirls is I was so obsessed with things as a teenager, but I guess I was so private about it myself because I had, I guess, some internalized misogyny, and I thought it'd be really uncool if I was like out about the things I liked. And what's so interesting now is like the musical has come out, and it's 100% a love letter to fangirls encased in like this musical comedy box. I call it like a Trojan horse. Like, it appears to be this musical making fun of young women only to smuggle them into your heart. But what's amazing is now the show actually has this whole community of supporters, and I get to see these teenagers, you know, teenage girls and people beyond the binary in our foyers all gathering with like their handmade signs, and they've met on Twitter and now they have these friendships. And I'm so quietly jealous of that community, because I never really was able to find that as a teenager, and that's why I'm so like enamored of fangirls and can't stop researching them.
Yeah, someone else has got in touch to say female fans or fangirls are routinely treated as if pathological or ill, or alternatively, as if they have no aesthetic judgment of whatever they're a fan of, but they can be incredible forces for real change. Listening to you, Eve, and that listener that's got in touch, I can really relate to that, because I think I shied away from becoming a so-called fangirl because I was worried probably by the backlash and the fact that society viewed them as crazy, essentially insane.
Right.
Yeah. So I shied away from it. But now looking back, I see that perhaps I could have easily been a fangirl had I been more willing to just be myself and perhaps be more free and more liberated in that aspect, Eve.
Yeah, right. And I think what's interesting there is for both of us, we decided that what was like socially acceptable for us to do and like the safe way to be was to behave in a way like according to what is socially acceptable for men to do. I think the reason why we cringe at fangirls is we live in a patriarchy that thinks emotions are embarrassing. And I think, you know, the reason that we cringe at fangirls is like we see like that outward expression of emotion as being inherently feminine and therefore like inherently... like, that's why I think why we dismiss it. But yeah, I just couldn't agree with you more.
Is there a difference between fangirl and fanboy then?
Oh, what a question. I mean, that's a huge question, but like the first word that comes to mind is judgment. Mm. Like, I think part of what inspired my research was, yeah, finding that, and Hannah, you've spoken to this, but finding that, you know, I became interested in 2015 looking at coverage of One Direction fans. And I was reading like mainstream news articles that were describing them as hysterical, crazy, over the top, psycho, desperate. And then I was watching as like sports fans were being described as loyal, passionate, and devoted. And I thought, this is really, really interesting, because to me, like, I thought, wow, this is a real microcosm of how we hand young men and women completely different words to describe themselves. And I guess that's what made me want to research fangirls, because I think the way that we talk to fangirls is a story about the way that we talk to young women.
Hannah, as well, there's a bigger element of this, a wider context, because some of these so-called fangirls are coming together, are grouping together to be, you know, considerable change in terms of political and societal views.
Yeah, I think that, well, I think fangirls, firstly, like, they're kind of organizing around the internet a lot now and like social media. So I think that you're thinking of like teenage girls who are, to be honest, like quite engaged politically, and they're like interested in things like identity politics. So it makes sense that they're kind of coming together and using fandom maybe as like one part of what they're talking about, but it's actually like using that as a lens to like see the world and, yeah, basically just like organize in that way.
And I know, you know, we're trying to change the perception of what a fangirl is, but is there sometimes a slightly stalker-like element to this, a dark side to fandom?
Yeah, it's interesting because I wrote the book, I went to America and I went to Japan to see if fangirls were different in other countries. And I actually was speaking to some Japanese fangirls who were really into One Direction, and Harry Styles was coming into the country and they knew that. And so like, I wanted to hang out with them and see like what they were doing. And they were like saying that they were going to meet Harry Styles at the airport. And so they actually used social media and sort of like checking in with different fans and to see like where he was at different points. And so they sort of all coordinated so that the Harry Styles fangirls in Japan could actually get to the airport and for the exact right moment at the right terminal and all of that kind of stuff to actually see him come through. So that is and I went with them to like actually see him come through. It was really fun and really funny. But yeah, there is an element of like stalker type activity to fandom. But I think people ask me all the time, like, did I find crazy fans when I was doing my research? And honestly, there was only one girl who I thought that fandom had taken over her life to an extent that it was actually detrimental to her life. But otherwise, everyone was like,
yeah,
really, yeah, having having a positive impact on their life.
Yeah, fascinating discussion. Thank you so much, Hannah and Eve. And it's something we're going to be continuing to talk about here on Woman's Hour. Tune into our next episode on Fangirls on the 31st of August. And just remember that Listeners Week is next week, where we're handing over the programme to you. So continue to get in touch with your stories, your passions, anything extraordinary that you've done, including hobbies. Get in touch in all the usual ways. And that's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
What is wellness?
I think of the image of wellness as like pure joy.
The important thing is for people to choose, like, what do you want to do?
Wellness are the things your grandmother told you to do.
When you really start to think about it, the answer feels more complicated. I'm Maya Feller, registered dietitian nutritionist and author.
And I'm Dr. Kavita Patel. We're the hosts of Well Now, Slate's new podcast on wellness.
Join us every Wednesday as we tackle that simple yet important question, what does it mean to be well?